Welcome to 30 Minutes of VOA Learning English, the voice of America's information service for people learning English. Join us now for our daily magazine show, As It Is, and other programs designed for English learners.
Hello and welcome back to the program that helps you learn American English. I'm George Grow in Washington. Each day, we present interesting stories from around the world. We always speak slowly and use words that are easy to understand. Today, we talk about really hot weather in India. By Thursday, the extreme heat was blamed for at least 1,400 deaths. Later on the show, we tell about a proposal to reduce tensions in the South China Sea. Listen carefully and save the program as a podcast so you can practice speaking American English whenever you have a chance. Now on to part one. Unusually hot weather is affecting people across large parts of India. As we hear from Anne Ball, temperatures reached and even topped 46 degrees Celsius.
Indians who had a choice stayed inside buildings or at home to escape the killer heat. But tens of thousands of people did not have that choice. Many of them are employed as construction workers, taxi drivers, and street vendors who make a living by selling goods to passers-by. Shaibaz Qureshi drives an auto rickshaw in the city of Hyderabad. He says the weather is a problem, but if he stops working, he will not be able to earn money. The number of heat-related deaths has climbed over the past week. Most of the deaths have been reported in the states of Andhra Pradesh and Telangana. That is where the highest temperatures were recorded. YK Reddy is a weather expert and the head of the meteorological department in Hyderabad. He told VOA this is the worst heat wave to hit the area in nearly 10 years. High temperatures are common in India in May and June. Dry winds blowing from the southwest have intensified the heat recently all across northern and central India. The hot weather has reached the capital, New Delhi. A national newspaper showed a picture of street tar and paint melting on the stripe markings of a walkway. Sunil Kumar Aledia is with the Center for Holistic Development in New Delhi. He says homeless people are the most at risk from the extreme heat. He says these men and women usually spend the night in government shelters during the winter months. But they get no break from hot weather at this time of year. Mr. Aledia says the shelters are usually cabins or tin structures, and in the summer they are only 10% full. He says this is because they lack electric fans, coolers, or drinking water facilities. So they become very hot. Officials in the worst affected states advise people to stay inside buildings during the afternoon when temperatures are the highest. They also say people should drink plenty of fluids and not go outside without a hat. In some places, doctors were told to cancel their leave plans because hospitals had so many cases of heat stroke. Many taxis in Indian cities operate without air conditioning equipment. In Kolkata, Two taxi drivers died from heat stroke last week. Their deaths led labor unions to tell taxi drivers that they could turn down passengers in the afternoon. The arrival of monsoon rains could offer some help from the oppressively high heat. But the worst affected states may not get an early break. That is because the rains get to the south and west of India first, before arriving in the northern and eastern plains. I'm Ann Ball.
You are listening to The Voice of America, and we are coming to you from Washington. Taiwan's president has offered a plan to ease tensions in the South China Sea. Ma Ying-jeou announced the plan on Tuesday. It calls for cooperation among governments that claim all or parts of the sea. Kelly Jean Kelly has more.
Mr. Ma proposed the peace plan at an Asia-Pacific research conference in Taipei. He appealed to those with claims to the South China Sea to end their territorial disputes and work together on resource exploration.
We emphasize that while sovereignty cannot be divided, resources can be shared, thereby replacing sovereignty disputes with resources sharing.
The South China Sea is said to be rich in oil, natural gas, and fisheries. The plan suggests that no nation take action on its own that could increase tensions. Taiwan and five other governments claim the 3.5 million square kilometer South China Sea. The sea stretches from the south coast of Taiwan to Singapore. Tensions have increased over the past year, and especially over the past few weeks, partly because of Chinese territorial claims to the area. China has taken steps to enlarge and develop several coral reefs. Observers say the development could be useful for China's armed forces. Last week, the Chinese government made an official protest to the United States after an American spy plane flew over one small island in the South China Sea. U.S. officials say the American planes are gathering intelligence about the development of the islands. They say the flights are happening in international airspace, which China does not control. Japan has also grown more active as it competes with China over rights to the East China Sea. In July, Japan will send 40 troops to a military exercise with the United States and Australia. It will be the first time Japanese soldiers have taken part in such an exercise. The Japanese government has also offered defense aid to Vietnam and the Philippines. Those two countries, and China, Taiwan, Brunei, and Malaysia, claim all or parts of the South China Sea. Mr. Ma's plan would establish systems to let different countries use the sea for humanitarian assistance, environmental protection, and aid for disasters. In 2012, he proposed a peace process for settling disputes in the East China Sea, parts of which are claimed by Taiwan, China, and Japan. VOA spoke to Joanna Lei about Mr. Ma's plan. She leads the Chenghua 21st Century think tank in Taiwan.
It is the least a president can do and should do. If everybody else discuss regional events and interests, at least you should stake your coin.
The announcement on Tuesday demonstrates Mr. Ma's Nationalist Party's foreign policy experience to Taiwanese voters. Elections are to take place in January. The Chinese government claims control of Taiwan. It has used its economic influence to ask that other countries avoid actions that would make Taiwan appear to be independent. I'm Kelly Jean Kelly.
And I'm George Grow in Washington. Thank you for spending some time with us today. You are listening to The Voice of America.
Coming up, more programs designed for English learners. You can read and listen to our reports and download MP3s at learningenglish.voanews.com. You can learn with us on Facebook, Twitter, and YouTube at VOA Learning English.
The United States Senate recently passed a measure called Trade Promotion Authority. Under the bill, the Congress can only vote for or against a trade agreement once it has been negotiated. This ability to fast-track such agreements would be important when Congress considers possible trade deals with Asian and Pacific countries and also Europe. But the issue of free trade can fuel a debate about U.S. jobs. Many labor unions and Democratic Party members support a little-known federal program for American workers. It is called the Trade Adjustment Assistance Program. It provides financial assistance to those who lose their jobs because of increased foreign competition. Conservatives say the program is ineffective and costs too much. However, a former steel worker who spoke with VOA says the program works and should be expanded. Michael Smith worked at the Bethlehem Steel Mill in Sparrows Point, Maryland. The mill was once a major producer of steel. It employed as many as 30,000 Americans. Mr. Smith was a crane operator for Bethlehem Steel for 13 years. Recently, he returned to the grounds.
I remember what this place used to be. I remember the sights, the sounds, the tractors. It's actually hard physically standing here. I mean, my heart hurts.
The mill closed in 2012 as a result of a series of business decisions and increasing global competition. That left Mr. Smith and 2,500 mill workers with no jobs and few marketable skills.
I was blessed enough to find a program called TRA and TAA, which is a union bargain benefit that was provided to us.
The TAA program gave Mr. Smith a weekly stipend. He used his retraining assistance to pay for books and school tuition fees. He recently completed his college studies and graduated with a bachelor's degree in psychology. Michael Smith's experience with the program was good. However, many conservatives say TAA is wasteful and ineffective. Dan Eikenson studies trade policies for the Cato Institute Research Group. He says that for every job lost to trade, 30 jobs are lost for other reasons. He spoke to VOA on Skype.
My first question is, why should we treat people who lose jobs or can tie their job loss in some way to trade any differently than we treat other people who lose their jobs?
Dan Eikenson says trade creates more winners than losers. Instead of government aid, he says, manufacturers are better equipped to retrain displaced workers. The Senate voted to extend the $400 million program as part of a fast-track bill to speed pending free trade deals with Pacific countries. The House of Representatives has yet to vote on the trade legislation. I'm Mario Ritter.
Welcome to the Making of a Nation, American History in VOA Special English. I'm Steve Ember. Britain was once the most powerful nation in the world. It ruled a far-reaching empire. This week in our series, we look at how British power gave way to American influence after World War II. One can almost name the day when this happened. It was February 21st, 1947. British diplomats in Washington called the State Department. They had two messages from their government. The first was about Greece. The situation there was critical. Greece had been occupied by Germany during the war. Now it was split by a bitter civil war. On one side of the fighting was the Greek royal family, supported by Britain. On the other side were communist-led rebels supported by Yugoslavia and the Soviet Union. British forces had helped keep Greece from becoming communist at the end of World War II. A few years later, Britain could no longer help. It needed all its strength to rebuild after the war. So on that February day in 1947, Britain told the United States it would soon end all support for Greece. Britain's second message that day was about Turkey. Turkey was stronger than Greece, but the concern was that it, too, could become communist unless it received outside help. Britain warned the United States that the Soviet Union would soon extend its control all the way across Eastern Europe to the Eastern Mediterranean. It called on President Harry Truman to provide strong American support to help Greece and Turkey resist the communist threat. Britain, in effect, was asking the United States to take over leadership of the Western world. The United States was ready to accept this new responsibility. For months, relations between the United States and the Soviet Union had been growing worse and worse. The two countries had fought together as allies in the Second World War. But Soviet actions after the war shocked the American people. The Soviet Union wanted to block Western political and economic influence in Central and Eastern Europe. It wanted to extend its own influence instead. So after the war, it forced a number of countries to establish communist governments. The Soviets sent troops into Hungary, Bulgaria, and Czechoslovakia to make sure its political demands were met.
From Stettin in the Baltic to Trieste in the Adriatic, an iron curtain has descended across the continent.
Britain's Prime Minister Winston Churchill described the situation in a speech in March of 1946 at Westminster College in the American state of Missouri.
Behind that line lie all the capitals of the ancient states of Central and Eastern Europe. Warsaw, Berlin, Prague, Vienna, Budapest, Belgrade, Bucharest, and Sofia. All these famous cities and the populations around them lie in what I must call the Soviet sphere. And all our subjects, in one form or another, not only to Soviet influence, but to a very high and in some cases increasing measure of control from Moscow.
Churchill warned that the Soviet Union was trying to expand its power. He described it as an iron curtain falling across the middle of Europe. This iron curtain divided Europe into a communist East and a democratic West. The situation was made even more tense by news coming from China. China was a divided nation at the end of World War II. The forces of nationalist leader Chiang Kai-shek controlled the southwestern part of the country. Communist forces under Mao Zedong controlled the north. Both the United States and the Soviet Union expected that Chiang Kai-shek would be able to unite China. Chiang and the nationalists won several early victories over the communists, but Mao and his forces used a growing hatred of the nationalist government to win support. Slowly, they began to win battles and capture arms. Early in 1949, communist forces took control of Peking, now Beijing, and Tianjin. They captured Shanghai and Canton. By the end of the year, Chiang and his nationalist forces had to flee to the island of Taiwan. The fall of the nationalist government on the mainland caused a bitter political debate in America. Some critics of the Truman administration thought the United States had not done enough to help the nationalists. The Truman administration rejected the charges. It said Chiang caused his own defeat by failing to reform and win the support of the Chinese people. Secretary of State Dean Acheson described the defeat this way. The unfortunate but inescapable fact is that the ominous result of the civil war in China was beyond the control of the government of the United States. Nothing that this country did or could have done within the reasonable limits of its capabilities could have changed that result. Nothing that was left undone by this country has contributed to it. It was the product of internal Chinese forces, forces which this country tried to influence but could not. A decision was arrived at within China, if only a decision by default. The United States was more successful in its policies toward Europe. The British warnings about the communist threat in Greece and Turkey led President Truman to speak to Congress. He said, "I believe that it must be the policy of the United States to support free peoples who are resisting attempted subjugation by armed minorities or by outside pressures." Truman called on Congress to give him $400 million in aid for Greece and Turkey. After a brief but intense national debate, Congress agreed. Truman then launched an effort to save the Greek economy and reorganize the Greek army. Soon after that, Yugoslavia and the Soviet Union ended their aid to Greek rebels. The civil war in Greece ended. American help for Greece and Turkey was the first step in what became known as the Truman Doctrine. The goal of this policy was to stop Soviet aggression anywhere in the world. Truman was willing to use military force to stop the spread of communism. But he also believed it was equally important to build up Western European nations so they would be strong enough to defend themselves. Europe was suffering terribly after World War II. There were severe shortages of food and fuel. Crops were destroyed. Many Europeans were beginning to look to the communists, to anybody, to save them. This is one reason why Truman and his advisors developed a plan to rebuild the economies of Europe. After the war, President Truman made George Marshall his Secretary of State. Marshall had led American troops as a general in World War II. Now, as the nation's top diplomat, he proposed the idea for rebuilding Europe. This idea became known as the Marshall Plan. President Truman explained why there had to be a Marshall Plan. People were starving, he said. There had been food riots in France and Italy. There was not enough fuel. People were cold and sick. Tuberculosis was breaking out. As Truman said later, something had to be done. Secretary of State Marshall described the plan during a congressional hearing in Washington.
Why must the United States carry so great a load in helping Europe? The answer is simple. The United States is the only country in the world today which has the economic power and productivity to furnish the needed assistance. The 6 8/10 billion proposed for the first 15 months is less than a single month's charge of the war. To be quite clear, this unprecedented endeavor of the new world to help the old is neither sure nor easy. It is a calculated risk. It is a difficult program. And you know far better than I do the political difficulties involved in this program. But there's no doubt whatever in my mind that if we decide to do this thing, we can do it successfully. And there's also no doubt in my mind that the whole world hangs in the balance as to what it is to be.
The United States offered aid through the Marshall Plan to all countries in Europe. The Soviet Union and its allies refused help. 16 other countries, however, welcomed the aid. From 1948 to 1952, administrators of the Marshall Plan worked with these countries. The United States spent $13 billion. The plan worked. Agricultural production in Marshall Plan countries increased by 10%. Industrial production increased by 35%. Production in some industries, such as steel, increased by much more. There were political results as well. Stronger economies helped prevent communists from gaining control of the governments in France and Italy. Some Europeans criticized the Marshall Plan. They said it increased tensions between the United States and the Soviet Union in the years after the war. Yet few could deny that the plan was one of the most successful international economic programs in history. Next week, we look at another way the United States provided aid in post-war Europe, the Berlin Airlift. You can find our series online with transcripts, MP3s, podcasts, and pictures at voaspecialenglish.com. You can also follow us on Facebook and Twitter at VOA Learning English. I'm Steve Ember, inviting you to join us again next week for The Making of a Nation, American History in VOA Special English.